Eric Klein is professor of classics and anthropology at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Klein is renowned for his expertise in ancient history and archaeology. His experience spans over 30 seasons, including excavations in Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Cyprus, and Greece. His numerous awards include 3 best popular books on archaeology accolades from the Biblical Archaeology Society, and being shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize for his incredible book, 1177 BC. Eric is currently collaborating with Glynis Fox to transform the narrative of 1177 into an immersive graphic novel. And this exciting endeavor is set to coincide with the eagerly awaited release of 1177 sequel after 1177, scheduled to hit the shelves in May 2024. Eric, it is an honor. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me to talk today.
Great. So you've actually spent several years excavating a number of sites, including Agios Dimitrios and Galavassos, which is topical for today. Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you to Cyprus so early in your career?
Sure. Well, I mean, apart from the fact that it's Cyprus, you know, who doesn't want to go there? It's absolutely gorgeous, friendly people, great food, excellent archaeology. So, yeah, I went there very early in my career. I was actually a graduate student at the time. And I dug at, as you said, at Kalavassos Agios Dimitrios, or KAD. I think I was there in 83 and 87. And then I was helping to lead the Brock Practicum in 1986 when we dug at Paphos with Dimitri Michalidis. And I think those are the 3 seasons I've been there. I've been there a couple of other times, mostly just, you know, visiting friends and roaming the island. But absolutely lovely. It's been far too long since I've been there, and I really do want to get back.
I myself just visited for the first time in 12 years, having been in a really, really long time. And it was incredible being there and getting to travel the island with my own car for a change. So
yes,
understand its draw. I bought your book, 1177, roughly around 10 years ago. Great book, easy to read, very accessible, loved it. And now you're going to be publishing 1177's graphic novel, which coincides with the 10-year anniversary of the first edition. So what has changed in these past 10 years?
Well, a lot has changed. In fact, so much changed that I asked permission and received it to update it. And a newer version, I would call it a revised and expanded, came out in 2021. Because so much new data had come out in the interim. I'm pleased to say that nothing contradicted what I had said in the original. It simply supported it. So from 2014 until 2021, we got a lot more data relating to the sciences. We got more ancient pollen data. We got data from a lot of other sources too, such as a stalagmite from a cave in Greece, sediments at the bottom of lakes up in, everywhere from Iran to Turkey down to Syria, more evidence from Egypt, also from Israel. What it showed is that the drought that was around at the end of the Late Bronze Age was much more widespread than I had anticipated. And in fact, there's now evidence for it from Italy on the west, all the way over to, say, Iran on the east, and from what is today Turkey down to Egypt. So with all of that, as I say, I asked permission to put out a revised edition, which I did. And there are changes throughout the book, but it's really the last couple of chapters where I itemize this new data. And what it did was change my mind. I had been on the fence, as you know from reading the original twice. I had been trying to be very objective and hands-off and, you know, we don't really know, but here's what we think. Well, in the revised edition, I actually do make a stand and I say, yes, it's still a perfect storm of everything, drought and famine and invaders and earthquakes and probably even disease. But of all of those, if I had to rank them now, I would rank climate change as the biggest driver, the biggest stressor. So, and of course, with the caveat that the climate change back then is driven by Mother Nature, it's not driven by humans, but nevertheless, the effects were tremendous. And so I actually do say that I think there's more lessons from back then that we can learn for today than even I had suspected when the original version was published. So lots of data. And even since 2021, I keep collecting the new articles and books that have come out. And there's even more data supporting all of that. So I do think that the Late Bronze Age collapse is a perfect storm of unfortunate events, as my kids would have said. It's a series of unfortunate events, but all leading to the collapse of the global network of interlinked societies. So that's what was new. And then we worked with Glynis, as you said, we worked with Glynis Fox, and she translated the book, the revised version. She translated it into a graphic version. So it is a graphic history of the Late Bronze Age collapse, and it's absolutely wonderful. She's got two young kids from that era, a young Egyptian girl, and a young sea people's boy, and they wander around the Mediterranean trying to figure out what happened. And then actually Glynis and I drop in to the story from time to time to just give a little background on what we're thinking today. But it is very faithful to the actual book. Those who have read the book will recognize page by page what we're going through. But our hope is that it will introduce a whole new group of readers to this story, anywhere from age 7 to 70. But I have to say, Glynis, marvelous artist. She is absolutely wonderful. And this graphic version is spectacular. I'm so proud of what she's done. And I can't wait for people to see that version.
I was lucky enough to have received from Glynis a couple of pages, and it looks amazing. It looks really, really fun to read. And you know, it really is a stroke of genius getting in touch with her, considering her background and her time in Cyprus as well. Were you familiar with her work? Like, how did you two get in touch?
Oh yeah, I was familiar with her work. We got in touch actually. I can tell you exactly where it was. It was at the annual meetings of the AIA, the Archaeological Institute of America, and they were in New Orleans. And so we were both at a happy hour. I forget for whom it was, but we were there. And I said to her, I'm working on a book on archaeology as a whole, an introduction. Would you illustrate it? And that was my Three Stones Make a Wall book, which came out in 2017. And she said, sure. And she made a drawing for each of the chapters, one for opening up the chapter and then another for within the chapter. And they were marvelous, like pen and ink sketches. And so based on that, and knowing already that she's an archaeologist as well as an illustrator, we had said to each other, wouldn't it be wonderful to do a graphic version? And of course, she's put out several other graphic novels. And so I kind of brought the idea to Rob Tempio at Princeton University Press and said, we should make this happen. It took a little while, but eventually it has happened. And so, yes, I was familiar with her work, and she was the one person that I wanted to have do this. And even though I knew she was excellent, this is beyond my expectations. It's just so marvelous to literally see it in full color and accessible to everyone.
for listeners who might not be aware about your book, let's talk about 1177. And specifically, I want to bring up a wreck that was discovered in 82, a 14th century wreck at Lubarun, which was discovered off the coast of Turkey. And this, I believe, this find was really an embodiment of the period. Could you kind of put into words what it represents to archaeologists, what it represents of the period?
Yes, absolutely. So let me put it all into context, the bigger picture and everything, and then you and the listeners will see how it's related. So basically, the book 1177, yes, it's about the late Bronze Age collapse just after the year 1200 BC, but when the Hittites go down, the Cypriots are affected, the Mycenaeans, Minoans, Canaanites, everybody. But what I do in the book, that's the beginning and the ending of the book. That's what Rob had asked me to write about originally. And what I said to him was, yeah, I'm happy to do that, but what I want to talk about is what collapsed. And so the whole middle part of the book is about the period from 1700 to 1200 BC, where I explore, you know, the Mycenaeans, the Minoans, the Hittites, and so on. And this shipwreck that you refer to, the Ulubarun shipwreck, which was discovered in 1982, as you said, excavations began in 84, and I believe they went until about 1996. This is a ship that went down in about 1300 BC, so it's right in the time period that I was exploring. And when it went down, one dark and stormy night, I imagine, it went down with its entire cargo. And the cargo has items from at least seven different cultures, maybe eight, including Canaanite pottery, Cypriot pottery, Egyptian artifacts, Mycenaean and Minoan pottery, and so on. But it has especially more than 300 ingots of solid copper, pure copper, which when tested indicate they most likely come from the mines on Cyprus. There's about, that equates to about 10 tons of copper. There's also about a ton of tin on board. And of course, to make bronze, you need 90% copper and 10% tin. And so those 10 tons of copper and 1 ton of tin on board are enough, as George Bass once said, he was the initial excavator, he once said that's enough bronze to outfit an army of 300 soldiers with everything, swords and shields and greaves and helmets. And so when this ship went down, somebody lost a fortune. Somebody probably went bankrupt. But we don't know if it's a private merchant or if it's a kingdom or a state, anything like that. It's also carrying lots of other raw materials. There's small ingots of raw glass, for example. There's also terebinth resin, which was used in making perfume, as well as to color wax. So for me, this Ulubarun shipwreck is a microcosm of the international connections of that time. It was a globalized period for that area and that age. Susan Sherritt has called it a globalized Mediterranean, and I think that's probably the best way to put it. Again, just like the drought that hit, the interconnected societies go from Italy on one side over to Iran and Iraq on the other, and even as far as Afghanistan, where quite a lot of the tin came from at that time. So this is a globalized time. It is a internationalized connected network of societies. And the ship that went down at Ulubarun literally is a microcosm of what was going on at that time, because you can see seven or eight cultures represented in the cargo that went down with the ship.
Who are the main players of the period?
Good question. So the main players, which I in the book I refer to them as the G8 or the G9 of that era. You've got Mycenaeans on the Greek mainland. You have the Minoans on Crete. You have the Hittites in Anatolia, modern day Turkey. You've got the Cypriots, of course, responsible for the copper. You have Canaanites along the coast of the Levant, what is today modern Israel, Lebanon, Syria. You have the Assyrians and the Babylonians in Mesopotamia, which would be modern day Iraq, basically. And of course, you have the Egyptians, can't leave them out. And then a group that most people have never heard of, but was active in North Syria, are the Mitanni. They actually come to an end before the rest of the groups. But we really do have eight, maybe nine great powers. And then a lot of lesser ones, lots of little city-states, especially in Canaan, where we have the names and places of some of the local rulers, like in Jerusalem, at Megiddo, at Hazor. And that's where we have other textual information that is available. There's a couple of archives that date to this period. So, for example, in Egypt, we've got the Amarna Archive, which is the royal archive of the pharaohs Amenhotep III and Akhenaten, Akhenaten being the famous heretic pharaoh who may have started monotheism. And that archive dates to much of the 14th century BC. And in addition to letters to the other great kings, king of Babylon, the king of Assyria, the king of the Hittites, the king in Cyprus, we also have lots and lots and lots of letters from the petty vassal kings in Canaan who are beseeching the pharaoh for one thing or another. We've also got an archive at the Hittite capital of Hattusa, which gives us an insight into the ongoings of the Hittites. And then there are a number of smaller archives that belong to merchants at the site of Ugarit in what is now coastal North Syria. And those give us an insight into the trade at the time. So between the various archives, we know about the history, the politics, the trade, the diplomacy, the royal marriages that went on. We've got quite a lot of information, so both textual and archaeological. We, in fact, know more about this period than most of the people walking along outside the street and, the general public have any idea. We're actually able to get a very detailed look at what life was like 3,400 years ago.
What do archaeologists slash historians, I mean, you alluded to this when we're talking about the written records, but what other pieces of evidence do archaeologists use to kind of piece together this narrative of decline and collapse?
So we're using pretty much anything we can. I mean, we've got your straight up archaeology, what you find when you're excavating, so the material remains of the buildings, also evidence, for example, of destruction, like if a site was destroyed, is it destroyed by humans in warfare, or is it destroyed by Mother Nature in the form of an earthquake? We have both of them for this time period. We are, in addition to the material remains, we're also, as I said, looking for the evidence from inscriptions. And these can either be clay tablets, as we find at Amarna and up at Hattusa and at Ugarit, or inscriptions on the walls and monuments. And that is, in fact, what we have from Egypt as well, where the pharaoh Ramses III leaves us a very detailed inscription concerning the invasion of what we call the Sea Peoples in 1177. He didn't call them the Sea Peoples. He actually gave them their individual names, the Peleset and the Shardana and the Shekelesh and the Ekwesh. We have other records from his predecessor, Merneptah, showing us that the Sea Peoples came 30 years earlier in about 1207. So lots of textual evidence. And now we're supplementing all of that with what some people are calling the third wave in archaeology, what Israel Finkelstein calls the exact life sciences. And this is where we get the scientific technology looking at things like ancient DNA of skeletons, burials at Ashkelon, for example, where we have people looking at palynology, the ancient pollen, the sediment and lakes, like I mentioned earlier. So we're coming at it now really from three big directions: the actual digging, the archaeology, the life sciences then of the things that we find, and then the textual inscriptions that we also come across. So it's a multi-pronged approach, and the result is that we have a plethora of data, which allows us to bring that period to life.
And that plethora of data kind of highlights what you alluded to earlier of a systems collapse, which you know, did a fantastic job of describing in your book. Do you mind explaining to listeners what the general features of a systems collapse is, and what in particular led to this collapse in 1177?
Sure. So the concept of a systems collapse goes back to Colin Renfrew, the famous British archaeologist. And back in 1978 and 79, he introduced this idea into archaeology, saying that systems collapse had happened a number of times throughout the history of humankind. And the Late Bronze Age collapse, to me, seems perfect as one of these collapses. What happens basically, complexity theory actually comes into this as well. Basically, the more complex a system gets, where you have multiple parts all working together, such as a globalized commercial network where you have eight or more societies all interacting, the more complex you get, the more likely it is that something is going to go wrong. And if only one thing goes wrong in a kind of a finely tuned network, it can throw everything else off kilter and kind of a domino effect. So, you know, if one society is affected, like the Hittites or the Cypriots or the Canaanites, and they start to teeter and fall, their collapse can generate a domino effect and also a multiplier effect where it becomes much larger than it should have been, and one by one brings down the other societies. So the analogy I make in the book is to an expensive race car where everything is humming along just fine, and then you get a rod that is thrown through the engine. It comes out, you know, one of the pieces of the engines breaks apart and goes through and just shatters the engine. Then all of a sudden, whereas, you know, a moment before you had a very expensive race car, now you have basically a smoldering piece of junk. And that's kind of what happens here. One moment, say up to about 1200 BC, we've got this finely tuned interacting network of societies, none of whom are self-sustaining, and that's kind of key. Then none of them can really stand on their own. They all need the materials that the others produce. So, for example, the Cypriots are sending out copper to everybody. There's tin, as I mentioned, coming from the region of Afghanistan and Uzbekistan and Turkestan, but also from southeastern Anatolia. Gold is coming from Egypt. silver. A lot of it's coming from the Lavrion mines outside of Athens, and so on. So the raw materials, the raw metals, but also the finished goods, they're all being traded around. So once something happens, and we don't know the order in which these things happen, but once the drought hits, for example, and then famine starts and earthquakes come in and possibly disease, and they start going down one by one, the Cypriots, the Hittites, the Canaanites, very quickly, just within a couple of decades, everything that they had known, everything that had been so prosperous for centuries by that point, just comes apart within just a couple of decades. Now, what Renfrew said in a systems collapse, that is exactly what I've just described, is exactly what happens in a systems collapse. He said one of the hallmarks is that you can't point to one single stressor or driver that caused it. There's no one smoking gun, that there are usually a multitude of factors, and we've got that. You also can't predict the order. We don't know which one collapsed first. Was it the Hittites? Was it the Mycenaeans? Was it the Egyptians? We don't know the exact order, but we do know what happened at the end, that it all came down to a collapse. Now, the other thing that he says with systems collapse is that there will frequently be a dark age afterward, a retreat to a lower level of socio-political complexity, and that so-called dark age will remain around for a period of time. It could be decades, it could be a century. He did point out that a systems collapse does not happen overnight, that it can take up to a century to happen, and in fact, that's exactly what happens with the Late Bronze Age collapse. I would say the 12th century BC sees that collapse. It starts by a little after 1200, and by 1100 BC, we have a completely different scenario going on. So that's typical of a systems collapse. And then he said that in that ensuing Dark Age, you also get the beginnings of stories that romanticize the period that had just come to an end. So think of Homer, for example, in the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the story of the Trojan War that is looking back to what has just collapsed. And in fact, the Trojan War, I think, probably took place somewhere around 1250 to 1200 BC. I think it's actually part and parcel of the overall Late Bronze Age collapse. And then Homer, who is pulling things together 500 years after the event, he and the epic poets before him have kind of idealized the Late Bronze Age. And indeed, even Hesiod, who is writing in the 8th century as well, he also looks back to a golden age and specifically says that his period is the age of iron and that he regrets living at that time. So I thought that the Late Bronze Age collapse is very aptly described as a systems collapse, and I added complexity theory in there just for good measure. I would, however, disagree in one aspect, and that is in writing the sequel after 1177. I now argue towards the end of the book that the period following the Late Bronze Age collapse is not necessarily what I or other archaeologists would designate as a Dark Age, because in those following centuries, there are a number of inventions, such as turning to iron, which may be the invention of the Cypriots, such as the invention of the alphabet, or rather not the invention, but the standardization, which the Phoenicians did. So in the sequel, I look around at what happened in those next 400 years, the ups and the downs, the topsy and the turvy. And in the end, I I actually, you know, spoiler alert, I make a plea to not call the following period a dark age, but rather to simply call it the Iron Age, which we know it was.
The people living in the late Bronze Age, would they have known that they were on the decline? And could they have done anything about it?
These are excellent questions, and I suspect that some people realized what was going on. We have, for instance, some evidence that the Egyptians were preparing for drought. There are studies that are now showing that they were interbreeding cattle with zebu, which are a type of cattle that are much more resistant to drought. We have evidence that they were planting more and more grain. So I do think the Egyptians in particular were aware of what was literally coming down the pike. And also the inscriptions from Merneptah saying that the Sea Peoples had invaded in 1207. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Egyptians were waiting for a second wave of invasions, which in fact did come in the time of Ramses III and 1177 BC, which is where the title of the book comes from. So I do think that some people were aware, but I also think that the vast majority were completely unaware and that they were caught unawares. So I don't think they knew overall. And even those that knew that they were going to be affected, I don't think they could ever have contemplated that the entire globalized network that they were a part of would have also collapsed. And in fact, my research for the sequel is showing to me that the individual societies, the eight or nine societies that are impacted, not all of them collapsed. Some of them were resilient. Some of them were able to transform. Others were not able to do, and they did collapse. But what actually collapsed was the network that was linking them together. And when that network collapsed, that was when they kind of retreated, many of them, to the lower level of socio-political complexity that Renfrew talked about. Now, could they have done anything about it if they had realized? Well, yes and no. I think, as I mentioned, I think the Egyptians did try to do something about it. But overall, I think no. When the end started to come, it came so fast and so rapidly that I think it was beyond their control. Had they been able to do any mitigation or damage control, it would have had to have been in the years and decades leading up to the beginning of the collapse. But once it began, and once the domino effects and the multiplier effects were in full force, I think at that point they just had to, you know, grab the seat that they were sitting on and hold on for the wild ride that was coming. And I think that that is where there are lessons for us today, because we do have a globalized, interconnected network around the world these days. Many of the countries, many of the societies today are, of course, not self-sufficient. And I think we have a lot of the same factors around today, as I point out in the book, as they had back in the late Bronze Age. And I say, they collapsed, so why aren't we worried about that? We might be, and oh no, we never will, we're too big to fail. Well, no, that's not true. And I think that if we don't do mitigation and try to anticipate what might be coming, by the time it does hit, it may well be too late. And in fact, that may be the case. We've already got, of course, climate change all around us. We've got the huge wildfires everywhere from California to Greece. We've got drought. We've got famine. We literally have most of the things, most of the elements that were around in the late Bronze Age that caused the collapse. we've got them again today. So I also think that then there are lessons to be learned in looking at what did the individual societies do after the collapse. And that's what I deal with in the sequel, the After 1177. I look at the individual societies and rank them. Who was the most successful at navigating the collapse? Who was resilient? Who transformed? And who didn't? And that's where, and again, a spoiler alert, I used the reports of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you know, this group that won a Nobel Prize back in, when was it, 2007, something like that. They issue these reports on climate change yearly. And back in 2012, they especially issued a report on extreme disasters and resilience and mitigation. And I think the Late Bronze Age collapse fits the definition of an extreme disaster. And so I actually used some of their definitions for resilience, transformation, adaptation, and all of that, and applied it to what happened in the Iron Age, and then tried to rank these societies as to how successful they were in responding to that disaster, and then again applied it to us today. And so, among other things, I decided that the Phoenicians and the Cypriots are among the most resilient. They actually flourish. They are anti-fragile, as Nassim Taleb has said. Anti-fragile is those who flourish in a time of chaos. And I think the Phoenicians and the Cypriots are the perfect examples of those, with the alphabet and iron. But others did not adapt, like the Mycenaeans and the Hittites, and they go away. And so I ask at the end of the book about us today. So are we Mycenaeans or are we Phoenicians? I think there are lots of lessons for us today, both in the original book and hopefully in this forthcoming sequel.
That's a really great angle. I really like that. It's a scary thought to, you know, turn that question upon ourselves. Like, you know, do we realize that maybe this is the beginning of something that we don't quite recognize yet?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I would say that, and actually I, with the ending of the sequel, I asked something similar to that. You know, do we realize we're in a collapse? What are we going to do about it? We do have, of course, a lot of pieces, a lot of people, very vocal people, saying that there is climate change, saying that we need to do something about it. But then we've got, you know, the deniers on the other side. No, it can't happen to us. Look, every society in the history of humanity has either collapsed entirely or transformed enough that it's almost unrecognizable in its new iteration. It would be hubristic to think that we're not going to collapse to at least some extent when everyone else has before us as well. So the question is, yeah, what are we going to do about it? And so this is one of the aspects where I do think that archaeology and ancient history is not only relevant to the modern world, but that it is part of our job to bring that to the general public and say, look, I know this is thousands of years old, but first of all, it's fascinating in and of itself. Look at these people. Look at what they did. Oh, my word, can you believe it? And then say, and look at what happened to them and what they had to deal with. And by Jove, how similar does this look to us today? I think there are lessons to be learned from what's happened before. So I do think it is part of our obligation to make archaeology and ancient history relevant to today, in part because our survival may depend on it. And so again, I end the sequel saying, are we going to do the right thing? Are we going to figure out a good response to what's going on today. And I say, I don't know. We don't know. We will have to leave it to future archaeologists and historians to render a verdict on how well we did.
You know, the Sea Peoples at one point were considered, I guess, the catalyst for the collapse, which, I mean, now that's been dismissed for obvious reasons that I hope you can kind of elaborate, that they were not as much the contributors to the collapse as much as they were victims. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, that's basically what I argued in the original book. And this is what others have said, Safius Orlando, for example, that the Sea Peoples are, how do we phrase it, are as much the victims as they were the oppressors. Yeah, it used to be, back when I was an undergraduate and in graduate school in the late 70s and early 80s, which is back when the dinosaurs roamed the earth now, I was taught that the Sea Peoples caused the Late Bronze Age collapse, and that these groups, which, as I mentioned, the Pharaoh Merneptah and Pharaoh Ramses III left inscriptions saying that they invaded Egypt in 1207 and again in 1177. They named the nine groups, as I mentioned earlier. We had like five groups one time, four groups another. They overlap. There's a total of nine. And they give us the names, like I mentioned, the Shardana, the Shekelesh, the Peleset. We don't actually know where any of them come from. There is a linguistic guessing game that's been played for more than a century now, where people have said, the Shardana, that sounds like Sardinia, and the Shekelesh, that sounds like Sicily, which indeed they do. But to be honest, the only one that we've really successfully identified, that everybody's agreed on, is the group called the Peleset, which is identified as the Philistines. Philistines known from the Bible, of course, but also known from archaeology. They are one of the groups that settle down and then rise up in the southern Levant, in Canaan. And we're pretty sure that we can identify the Peleset with the Philistines. And in fact, in the graphic version of 1177, I mentioned that Glynis has two young kids as kind of the people running around trying to figure out what caused the collapse. And one of them, the boy, is a sea person whose name is Pel, P-E-L. And very early in the book, you find out that it's short for Peleset. So there you go. Now, the Sea Peoples themselves, I could say they're still a mystery. It has been long thought that they came from elsewhere, the Aegean or wherever, and indeed that may be the case, because I mentioned earlier about the exact life sciences and studying ancient DNA. And a couple of years ago, there was a DNA study made of four young infants that were found buried under the floors of houses at the site of Ashkelon, which is now in southern Israel, down by the Gaza Strip. And those four infants tested roughly like 40% local Canaanite, but 60% other. And when you run the computer models, the most likely other is either Crete or Spain or like Sicily, Sardinia, which fits. Now, the little kids themselves, with this 60% other and 40% local Canaanite, they are not Sea Peoples themselves. They actually date from late in the 12th century or even early in the 11th century. So they're like two generations removed. So like their grandparents, it looks like one of them would have been a sea person and the other would have been a Canaanite. And that they, the Sea Peoples basically assimilated. We're thinking now more peacefully than had been previously thought, and that these four infants are the offspring of the offspring. They're the, you know, second generation or so, wow, and showing how they intermingled. So lots of new information and more to come, because obviously four infants is really too small a sample on which to base all kinds of conclusions. So we need to do more testing of other of these burials if we can get them. So lots to go on.
You know, it's been speculated that some of the Sea Peoples destroyed Cypriot cities or alternatively settled in Cyprus, and some cases may have even come from Cyprus itself. Do we have any information on the current evidence and what it suggests?
Well, excellent question. Everything's changing. Everything is fluid. What we thought we knew back in the 80s, where there was at least one wave, if not two waves, of Sea Peoples, and we could take a look at particular sites and say, oh yes, that's where they settled. Everything's now being called into question, and it's a much more fluid situation. We do still think that the Sea Peoples are part of the picture, right? We do not dismiss them, but they are not the complete answer. And we're not so sure what exactly is going on at each of the individual sites in Cyprus. Lots of interesting sites like Ma Paleocastro and Pila Kokinokrimos, and then, of course, Enkomi and Kidion. But exactly what's going on and how much is local and how much is foreign influence, how much is invasion, and how much is a more cosmopolitan mixing of everyone. Like I say, it's a very fluid situation, which makes it fascinating and interesting, because we are now questioning all of our original assumptions and going back and looking and reanalyzing the data. So I would say, you know, hold on as things change. We do know that, you know, Cyprus is wrapped up in the collapse, but exactly what's going on, again, as I say, the interpretations are very fluid, and the new excavations that are being conducted, such as at Hala Sultan Tekke, for example, which is coming up with marvelous, marvelous finds that Peter Fisher mm-hmm. and his team mm-hmm. are coming up with, there's going to be a lot of new evidence that is coming out and will be published in the next couple of years, I think, that will substantially flesh out the picture and give us more details.
You hinted at it with your sequel to 1177, Cyprus actually having been one of those polities that managed to come out on the other side of the collapse relatively unscathed, although there's no doubt about it, it was impacted, of course. But just a quote from 1177, you actually wrote, "Cyprus seems to have survived these deportations essentially intact. There is now every indication that the island was flourishing, and Cyprus's resilience came about only as a result of the rather dramatic restructuring of its political and economic organization, which allowed the island and its polities to weather the storm." Can you just elaborate a little bit on that? What was so unique to Cyprus that allowed it to emerge relatively unscathed?
Well, this is actually a great question, and I, to be honest, none of us can answer that yet. It's one of the ongoing interesting mysteries still of the period. Part of the problem is, while we have a lot of archaeological evidence, we don't have that much textual evidence. So we don't have that many inscriptions. We don't have the archives that we have elsewhere. You know, we do have, as I mentioned earlier, we've got letters from the king of Cyprus to the Egyptian pharaohs back in the 14th century. There are also letters in the archives of the merchants at Ugarit from the governor and the king of Cyprus that take us down to about 1200 BC. And there are a number of inscriptions in Phoenician and in other languages that are on Cyprus itself from the period afterward. But a lot of what we're going on is kind of analyses, suppositions, intuitions, and pure guesstimates, I guess you could say, of what must be going on from looking at the movements at the time and what happens later. So, for example, we know that there are a number of cities that do continue from the Bronze Age and then the Iron Age, but we also know that some are abandoned and new settlements are made, you know, a couple of kilometers away. And this is where we get places like Salamis and Enkomi and Kidion being affected, and sometimes the inhabitants moving to a new location a couple of kilometers away, and other instances where things keep going. And so the excavations at sites like Enkomi, Kidion, and Paphos, for that matter, are giving us a lot of information, but right now it's subjective interpretation. And we can see later that we get the city-states on Cyprus, such that when the Neo-Assyrians, when the Neo-Assyrian rulers mention pulling Cyprus into the orbit of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, and they list the various places, the city-states on Cyprus, we know that they must have been developing during the Iron Age, just like we know over in Greece that the city-states, the idea of the polis, was being developed during the Iron Age, because when we come out into archaic and then classical, both Cyprus and mainland Greece as two examples, with the city-states up and running, we can see that there must have been development back in the Iron Age. But exactly what's going on and the chronology, this is, I think, a very fascinating portion of history still to examine. I think we will get to the bottom of it, and that we will either be able to say, yes, we're correct, or no, let's tweak it a little bit. But I think especially in the case of Cyprus, this is where the archaeologist's favorite expression, we have to dig more. We do. We have to excavate more. Mm-hmm. And we have to, in particular, focus on the Iron Age phases at some of the sites on the island, and see if we can tease out in a little bit more detail exactly what happens during the period from, say, 1200 down to 800 BC. And that, I think, is a really interesting period that we need to know much more about.
Are you able to tell us what exactly they did that allowed them to kind of roll with the punches during this tumultuous period?
Well, that is one of the things that I try and figure out in the second half of the book, in the sequel, the After 1177, the subtitle is The Survival of Civilizations. I spend the first half of the book going through the history. And originally it was a chronological traipse through the centuries, much like 1177, where I had a chapter on the 12th century, then the 11th, then the 10th, then the 9th. And, you know, it just didn't work. It was too much whiplash, seesawing back and forth between the different societies. So in the end, I've changed the format of the book to be geographical, case studies, if you will. So I've got usually two case studies per chapter. So for instance, I have in one chapter the Cypriots and the Phoenicians together. And then in another chapter, the Mycenaeans and the Minoans. In another chapter, the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and so on. And so I go through, for the benefit of the readers that aren't familiar with what happened in the period from 1200 to 800 BC, I give them the basic history that we've reconstructed from the archaeological remains and the text. And there are, at this point, a lot of inscriptions. And then in the second half of the book, along with invoking the definitions of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and talking about resilience and transformation, there I literally asked the question that you just asked. What was it that the people that survived did that was right? And what was it that the people who didn't survive do that was wrong or fail to do? It's a guess on my part. I can't always be sure. But for instance, the Cypriots, I think, are able to survive in large part because it looks like they pivoted from being the main producers of copper. They still do continue to produce copper, but they now, the newest thinking is they are at the forefront of developing the iron technology. And that in addition to shipping iron weapons and tools everywhere, both to the southern Levant in one direction and to Greece, for example, in the other direction, they are also sending out the idea, the technology. And so iron working spreads quite rapidly because iron is found, you know, everywhere. You can get iron ore almost everywhere, as opposed to copper and tin. And so one of the things that I think allowed the Cypriots to survive is this pivot from copper to iron, even though they are very different technologies, as some of the Cypriot archaeologists and metallurgists have pointed out. For the Phoenicians, I think they were able to survive because they moved into the vacuum that was left by the collapse of cities like Ugarit and the other maritime powers. The Phoenicians took over the sea. As one person has called it, the Mediterranean became a Phoenician lake. And so the Phoenicians pivot that way. And of course, they're able to spread the standardized alphabet, but also standardized the production of purple dye. And so they're able to survive that way. Other groups, one of the other groups that survived quite well were the Neo-Assyrians over in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq. And they, the Neo-Assyrians are a different story. They are actually not as affected by the collapse, at least at first, as most of the other societies. So the climate change doesn't seem to have impacted them as much right away. They do get hit with a drought and famine. We know this because of the textual records that the kings left to us, the royal inscriptions, where they talk about drought and famine. But it doesn't seem to have started until about a century after all the other major powers had gotten hit. And so in the case of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, their basic late Bronze Age structure remained intact. They still have the king, they still have the royal court, they are still writing, unlike places like Greece, where they basically forgot how to learn how to write. In Assyria, they always knew how, they never forgot. And so we've got royal inscriptions, we've got economic tablets, things like that. The religion continues. Basically, life continues as they had known it in Assyria, like I say, for another century. And even then, when the famine hits, the drought hits, and disease hits, and they go down, the Assyrians go down for about 100, maybe 150 years, they still do not lose everything. They still maintain a hold on what they had had. And so when they come back up and we get the beginnings of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, you know, 10th century, 9th century, they're up and running almost without having lost a beat. So what I've done, and I think this is going to be controversial at the end of the book, I rank the different societies as to how well they did, as I mentioned, in the aftermath of the collapse. But I also list some of the features that I think help them. either be resilient and transform, or at the very least, to cope and adapt, and actually give them a numerical ranking and put them in a chart as to what they can do. And then at the end, I put together kind of a common sense set of 8 or 9 or 10 rules as to what one should do in the event of realizing that one's society is collapsing. And again, they're common sense rules, but the upshot is that there is no one golden rule for what to do and how to transform. Each of the 8 or 9 societies responded in a different way. And so one of the other analogies that I've made at the end of the sequel is that it's as if we are in a foot race. And the starting line is the collapse in, say, 1200 BC. And everybody takes off running in response to the collapse at the same time. But they go at their own pace, and they reach the finish line, as it were, at different times, and some don't reach it at all. But by the time we get to the mid-8th century, we are back up and running in terms of an internationalized network of connected societies once again. But there are some new players at that time that were not around in the Bronze Age. I mean, the Canaanites have been replaced by the kingdoms of Israel, Judah, Ammon, Moab, the Edomites. The Mycenaeans have been replaced by what we would then call the archaic and classical Greeks. The Hittites have been replaced by various groups up in Turkey, including the Phrygians, and so on. So in some ways, it's a completely new world. But unfortunately for us today, I was not able to hand down one golden rule. If you do this, you will survive. Because as I say, each of them had their own responses, and each was either successful or not in antiquity.
I'm really, really looking forward to both the release of the graphic novel and the sequel to 1177, which again comes out in May. And Eric, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your knowledge on the period, on Cyprus, on 1177's graphic novel, and on its sequel. Really looking forward to it, Eric.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure to talk about these periods. This is, I think, some of the most fascinating time periods in human history. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk here. And I'm very hopeful that people will enjoy both the graphic version of 1177 and the sequel when they drop on the same day in May of 2024. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Right. Bye. Bye.